We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk show. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. Back in late 2009, the government of Greece announced that the country's debt had reached record levels, and that led to fear throughout Europe that perhaps the country of Greece might actually default on its debt. So in exchange for a very large loan, the EU demanded that Greece cut spending, and it did, and it adopted a policy of austerity that was met with a good deal of anger, with demonstrations and strikes by people in Greece. This morning in this hour of Focus, we will talk a little bit about Greece, but try to enlarge the frame here, the conversation, a bit more, and talk about the economic crisis in Europe and how that relates to European politics and perhaps why people in the United States should be interested. And then our guest for the program is Kostas Kourtikakis. He's a professor here in the Department of Political Science. He's a research assistant professor, and he is interested in, certainly he's interested in Greek politics, but also in European politics and in the EU. And we'll try to talk a little bit about the Greek crisis, yes, but also talk about how that relates to the economic problems of other countries in the Eurozone. And questions from people who are listening are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. And if you'd like to send us an email, you can do that as well, will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, thank you very much for being here.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
You know, we want to talk specifically about Greece, and because it, at least in the last couple of months, that it has been in the news because of the response of the Greek people to the actions of the Greek government. But there is a larger story here, and perhaps it's for us here in the United States, it may be kind of getting lost because we've been worried about our own economic problems. But that we seem to have a spreading crisis of confidence in the economies of Europe, and it's something that is affecting both large countries and small countries. And so we have a small country like Greece, but just in the news today, there seem to be concern about France, which is one of the biggest, strongest economies in the EU. And you would think, well, the French would be okay. About the only country that seems to be exempt from worries is Germany. And even there, you know, if the whole thing would fall apart and they'd have to go back to the Deutschmark, I don't know whether that'd be such a great thing for Germany. Can you, just to start out, can you put this in some sort of a larger context? What is going on here?
Well, Greece, as you said, is a small country. Not as small as you might think, perhaps, because it's the 40th largest economy in the world. Mm. But it's part of a larger organization, which is the European Union. Which is a club of rich nations. It's also a member of the Eurozone, which is even a more exclusive club inside the European Union. Those are the 17 countries that have given up their traditional national currencies and they have adopted a common currency, the euro. So although Greece by itself is not as important, perhaps, it's big, but it's not huge, and it's a small part of the European Union, of the Eurozone. Mm-hmm. It's still a member of this club, and its actions reflect upon the club as a whole. So what happened in 2009, as you mentioned, markets lost faith in Greece and its ability to pay back its debt. And so they started digging the markets and said, well, if Greece is a member of this club, and if it's in trouble, maybe Portugal is also in trouble. Maybe Spain is also in trouble. Italy, France, all the countries. So there was this domino effect. Mm-hmm. And then that goes even further. So if the members of such a rich, a wealthy, elite club cannot pay off its debt, maybe that's true for all industrialized nations. And that's where the U.S. fits in a way. So I think what has happened, what happened with Greece is that it started a chain of events that spread doubt in international markets about the ability of industrialized economies to pay off its debt. So international investors are very unwilling to lend money to these countries. Mm-hmm. And as a result, what we see happening everywhere in Europe and now in the U.S. is that governments try to persuade the markets that, no, no, we can pay off our debt. You can trust us. And how do they send this signal? It's by implementing austerity measures. So austerity now is the buzzword everywhere. Even here in the United States, the most recent debate in Congress essentially reflects that necessity, that new reality in international economy, that governments need to cut spending because they need to persuade Standard & Poor's and the other rating agencies that they're good, creditworthy economies so that international investors can lend them money again.
Yeah. It's striking because, it certainly should be said that as you look from one country to the next, conditions in countries are different. Mm-hmm. You know, their financial situation is different, and their problems are different. And also, some countries have heavy debt load, and others not so heavy. And in fact, there have been some places where you'd have to say, well, they've actually done pretty well, and they've been pretty mm-hmm. responsible. But it doesn't seem to matter whether Portugal, for example, I think their debt wasn't all that high. And yet it's one of those countries that's now seems to be on the watch list that people mm-hmm. are worried about.
Yes. I think a big part of it is psychological. And also, this is a political problem. It's very often described as an economic problem. And at the very heart, it's an economic problem. It has to do with the economy. It has to do with GDP and growth and all that. But it's a political problem. And there is a series of political decisions that have been made in Europe that have led to the current situation. So yes, you're right. Every country is different. So, for example, in the case of Greece, it was, as it turns out, it was government spending that led to the crisis. Mm-hmm. In the case of Ireland, it was very different. It was that banks actually borrowed a lot of money from internationally, and then the Irish government had to get in and bail them out, and that's how it accumulated debt.
Yeah.
But overall, however, they all face the same problem, which is for whatever reason, they can't pay off their debt.
Well, I want to talk specifically a little bit about Greece. And it seemed that I'm sure that probably some people would say, well, that all started when they joined the Eurozone, when mm-hmm. they adopted the euro. And that apparently did make it possible, make a lot of cheap money available.
Mm-hmm.
So it made
Absolutely.
It possible to borrow, which they did. The Greek government borrowed and spent. Greek consumers, I think, also borrowed and spent.
Yes.
But the government did. So what was it that they spent this money on?
Well, every government has choices to make. And when it comes to the economy, the main goal is to increase the wealth of the society. And there are many ways to do that. One of them is to make the economy more competitive, which means that the economy can produce products that can that people want to buy, so they can be exported. That brings income. And so the welfare of the society increases. That's the more difficult way of increasing the wealth. There is a more easy way to do that, and that's to borrow money, which Greece was able to do after it joined the euro, very, very cheaply with very low interest rates. Now it was part of the prestigious club, so it could have equivalent, the appropriate interest rate. And so it was able to borrow very cheaply, and so a lot of that money went to infrastructure projects, but also a lot of it went to, increasing salaries and pensions and that sort of thing. But I would like, though, to go a little bit further back in time and discuss a little bit, because the reason Greece was able to do that is because of the way the euro and the regime that surrounds the euro is actually structured. So the reason why Greece was able to do that is because it's a part of the euro, and there are loopholes in it, which a lot of Greek politicians were able to take advantage of.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. and the way the euro is set up, essentially, is that it's a monetary union. There is a common currency. But there is no fiscal or political union that is associated with this monetary union. And that is quite a unique situation. There's no precedent of that. And it's very difficult to manage a monetary union without having a fiscal and political union. Instead, what the euro regime is about is a coordination. So there is one common monetary policy. There is one euro. There is one central bank which determines how this currency will behave. But then as far as fiscal policy is concerned, that's the budget, how much each country spends and how much each country, you know, how much revenue it collects. That's up to each individual member state. And so there is a coordination mechanism for fiscal policy, but there's no coordination option for monetary policy, just centralized. So that gives the opportunity to countries to essentially manage their own budgets and perhaps, you know, behave not as prudent as they can. And I think that there is a lot of talk in the news about, you know, how Greece failed to live up to its expectations. And I think that's largely true. But I think it's a little bit unfair also, because there were politicians who tried really hard to change things and increase the competitiveness of the Greek economy. It was just very difficult to do so, because every time they tried to implement reforms, there was a lot of reaction by the people who didn't want to lose their benefits, who didn't want to lose their free education. I think the most glaring example was perhaps educational reform that the previous government, it was a conservative government, they tried to reform, you know, the educational system, the universities, to make them more sort of efficient, linked to the market, more cost efficient. There was major upheaval and a lot of reactions, so the government gave up. So I'm sure there is corruption, and I'm sure that politicians in Greece didn't do all they could. They could have tried harder. But even when they tried, they found a lot of resistance. So at some point, they gave up. They shouldn't have, but they did. Mm-hmm. And they started, they reverted to the easy solution that I mentioned earlier.
Our guest in this hour of Focus is Kostas Kotkakis. He's a research assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at University of Illinois here in Urbana-Champaign. We're talking about the current economic crisis in the European Union. Specifically here, we've been talking about Greece, but we're also talking in a larger sense about what's going on in other countries as well. And questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I had read that apparently when George Papandreou, who is the current Prime Minister of Greece, when he came into office in the fall of 2009, he and took a look at the books, he says he was shocked. And he said that he was stunned by the level of debt and the fact that previous governments had hidden that. Mm-hmm. Really? Was that really a surprise?
Well, he's a politician, so you have to take his word for it. But it's an open question, and there is a lot of information that has been revealed since then, which demonstrates that he was not unaware of that. Mm-hmm. But this is a good case, or an interesting case of Greek politics, in fact. This is not the first time this has happened. Actually, his predecessor, Kostas Karamanlis, who was the previous prime minister, when he actually took over as prime minister 4 years earlier, he had done the exact same thing. He had revealed, to the shock of everybody, that, in fact, the previous socialist administration, so that was the same party as the current prime minister, had, in fact, not reported the figures accurately. But that gives you a sense of how Greek politics, and in fact, politics works. There is a very polarized political culture, and with two political parties that try to essentially point the finger at each other and say, you did things wrong. No, you did these things wrong. What they didn't anticipate, what they didn't take into account, was that so this was part of this regular blame game that happens in a lot of, you know, political scenes, including Greece. What they didn't anticipate is the reaction of the markets. So this had happened before, but this particular instance of the blame game happened right after the Lehman Brothers had collapsed. The international markets were very, very sensitive. So as soon as they found out about this, they went crazy, essentially, after that. And what's interesting, though, is that this blame game continues even today. Greece is dominated by two parties, Greek politics, the Socialist Party, which is currently in power, which means it controls both the parliament and the executive, the prime minister's office and the cabinet. So that's a moderate left, a party of the left. And then there is the New Democracy Party, which is a conservative party, moderate right-wing party. And even during the crisis, what you saw happening, for example, in at the end of June of this year, was that instead of trying to work things out and, you know, try to deal with the crisis together, what happens is that they started blaming each other for the crisis, and that made things even worse. And it doesn't have to be like that. They could work things through. So in many ways, in fact, the recent debate in Congress reminded me very much. You know, I was watching the debate in the Greek parliament, and that debate in Congress reminded me very much of that debate in Greece.
Mm-hmm. Well, in what people now will recall is that, at least going back a little bit earlier in the summer, there was a great deal of unrest. People were really very angry. There were demonstrations, and that. So if and you can understand that if you look at the context that previous to that, governments in their benefits, what were provided to people, were very generous. And what happened, the austerity measures that they were forced to adopt in exchange for getting the bailout from the EU involved things like cutting Social Security, cutting the wages of public workers, raising taxes, a very broad range of things, which no doubt for a lot of people in Greece were pretty painful, and one could at least understand why it is that people would be out in the streets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I think I would like to point out that, you know, you see a large crowd of people demonstrating, and of course, each one of them demonstrates for a different reason. Mm-hmm. And I would like to point out that there is a big misconception out there, especially if you read the German press, as I do sometimes, that all employees, especially public employees, they make 3,500 euros a month. They live, you know, this great life. You know, they have yachts out, and they go out on vacation in the Greek islands or whatever that may be. But I think we need to, if you take a closer look, you'll see that the picture is a little bit more complex and complicated. And the way I like to describe it is that the Greek economy and the Greek society is essentially bipolar. And what I mean by that is that we need to distinguish between the public sector and the private sector. Because there is a public sector that is indeed, as the stereotype goes, you know, rather inefficient. People do not work to the best of their abilities, perhaps. And at the same time, they get really, really good pensions, really good salaries, great benefits. And so they are pampered in many ways. Not as much as most people think. Not everybody makes 3,000 euros a month. But a lot of people make a lot more than they produce, let's put it this way. And then on the other hand, there is a private sector, which is the complete opposite of the public sector. We're talking about people who work really, really hard overtime. Sometimes they don't get paid for that overtime. And so they don't make a lot of money, so they have very limited benefits. Sometimes labor laws are not applied the way they're supposed to. And I know specific examples. And my favorite two examples are actually my brother and my sister-in-law. My brother works in the public sector. He gets all the plush, good benefits. He's a teacher. My sister-in-law, she works for a private company. She has a business degree that imports medical equipment. And she works longer hours than my brother, but she makes less money, and she has fewer benefits, fewer pension benefits. So sometimes I think, again, it's unfair to present everybody as being in the same boat. They are essentially in the same boat because they all have to deal with the consequences. But, you know, somebody who is in the private sector and sees their benefits slashed and then on top of that is accused of having enjoyed really good benefits in the first place, you know, sometimes I can understand why they get so outraged about this.
Well, we have a caller and would welcome others into the conversation. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. You may also send us an email, will-talk@illinois.edu. And our guest in this hour of focus is Kostas Kourtokakis. He's a research assistant professor in the Department of Political Science here at the University of Illinois. Here's a caller in Champaign County to start us off, line one. Hello.
Hi, I thought I was going to agree with you there, but the statistics about productivity and hours worked and vacation are not that much different in Greece than in the rest of the Eurozone. So I wanted to dispel this stereotype commonplace about Southern Europeans, which I guess you might agree with me with. I don't think that the difference between public and private is as grave as you suggest. It's a stereotype of this country too. So it plays into a narrative that I think that is dominant and not a little bit too unexamined. But you didn't mention the role of the financial multinational financials. I believe it was Goldman Sachs that was involved with the previous government, the Wright government, to hide using a variety of these new financial instruments to hide the debt, so that the Greek government could say that the ratio was in line with the Eurozone's prescriptions, et cetera, et cetera. I do agree with your overwhelming idea that, you know, it's kind of odd that the Eurozone doesn't issue bonds on its own to finance what it needs to do. But I also think there's a context here that isn't spoken of, and that's the idea that some of the proponents of the Eurozone were into this idea of harmonization upwards as opposed to harmonization downwards, and that's where a lot of the cash transfers to the periphery originated from, and I think it was an admirable thing. Now, in a way, the Irish took it and applied it to neoliberal policies, and that's sort of where, in a way, where the crash started first, with the housing bubble collapsing. So it's all very complicated and needs to be sorted out, but I think some of the commonplaces that we just sort of agree with unexamined are distort the idea, and I think that the idea of harmonization up doesn't get revisited. An economist observer that I like a lot likes to call the current German polity the sadomonetarists, because they want sort of a monetarist solution as opposed to any kind of policy that looks at human needs and authentic growth as opposed to bubble economies. So obviously I'm coming from a different direction.
Let's get some response.
Okay. Well, about the division between private and public, I think you're right. I may have overplayed a little bit just to make a point, but I think there is a big difference between this distinction in the U.S. than in Greece. At least that's my sense. But I don't want to dwell too much on this, because you raised some really interesting points later. But Goldman Sachs, the reason I didn't mention about Goldman Sachs and the other big banks in the U.S. is because there's not much known about their role. We know they played a role. At least I don't know much about their role. And I think there's probably a good reason for that, is because they don't want people to know about it. At least that's what I assume. But I haven't read a lot about their role. I know they played a role. And actually, no government, I think, especially not the Greek government, wouldn't have the expertise to change the numbers on its own. Now, I think you raised the most interesting, I think, point that you raised is this issue of harmonization, because I think it's at the very, very heart of the problem. And I agree with you that it was the purpose of the euro regime was to harmonize everybody up. So the euro essentially behaves in many ways, and it was created in the image of the Deutsche Mark. At least that's what a lot of people think. And the idea was that a lot of countries would change their behavior, so they would have this common currency. They have to live under this common currency, so they now have to modify their behavior. It's a strong currency. There is a strong bias against inflation, and so they would have to make their economies more competitive, just like Germany has always been doing. Germany is actually doing very well right now, precisely because it has a very competitive economy. But I think... And that's obviously a very admirable goal, and that's something that you can find a lot of people that will disagree that it's a good thing for an economy like the Greek economy or the Portuguese economy or the Spanish economy or even the Italian economy to behave more like the German economy. But that's, I think, is a little bit of a trap. And the reason why I think that is because it creates, in a way, unrealistic expectations. If you ask economists, of course, it's possible. But if you ask political scientists, myself, I mean, the political reality is sometimes very much more difficult to manipulate. So, yes, it sounds very good in theory, you know, revising, changing those economies to behave more like Germany. But in practice, the political realities are very different. They prevent that from happening. So to me, the big dilemma for these people who make decisions and who design regimes like the euro regime is, how do you construct the rules? How do you construct the conditions under which the euro functions? Do you create these high expectations, expecting that some of the countries will fail? Or do you tone down the expectations and perhaps you create rules that are not as ambitious, but they create goals that are much more attainable? That is not an issue we can resolve right here. That's why I said this is a political crisis. It's a matter of choices that governments make. And it seems to me that the approach they have followed, the most ambitious one, doesn't seem to be working. I would like for it to work, and I'm sure a lot of people would like it to work, but to me, it doesn't seem to be working as it was supposed to.
Well, I guess I could give the caller just a very quick follow-up.
Yeah, well, of course the large financial institutions don't want to reveal what's going on, and I think that that consequently leads to a lot of uncertainty about what kind of, you know, what I'm trying to get at is these credit default swaps and all the side bets that are being made on the Greek currency and the other currencies. This is all not transparent either, so we don't know which actors are acting on what behalf, and you know, they make money when there's uncertainty in a currency. It's really an insidious setup, and not examined enough. So I appreciate the opportunity to bring it up. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Well, other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. And you can also send us an email if you'd like. It's will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, just again, sticking for a second with Greece and stipulating that you're a political scientist and not an economist, I think some people are still in given that now that there's been these two big loans to Greece, there are still questions about Greece, about the Greek economy, and whether, in fact, the country might still end up defaulting.
Yeah, I think there is general consensus that Greece will default. At least that's what I understand the economists are saying. But what they're trying to do is make it an orderly default. So they want to do it in a way that's not catastrophic for the Greek economy. But as far as real people are concerned, I think there is no question that Greeks will have to change the way they live. I think the next generation of Greeks will have to make do with a lot less. They will have fewer opportunities, you know, for good jobs. They will definitely not have as many benefits as their, you know, parents, perhaps. But then at the same time, it's, again, a political decision. Greece, as I mentioned in the beginning of the interview, is a large economy. I mean, it's very often described as small. It's smaller than the U.S., definitely. It's smaller than France and Germany, but it's the 39th largest economy in the world out of 220. So it has potential. The question is, how do you tap into that potential? And quite frankly, I think it's time for the Greek government and the people of Greece to start thinking of their country in a different light. It can no longer be about agriculture and tourism anymore. I mean, these are not, you know, you can't produce, you know, a lot out of these industries. It needs to reorient its economy to different activities. I mean, people have said, you know, green energy, you know, there's a lot of solar power, wind power, you know, new technologies. You know, how do you reform universities so that they produce, you know, they're more engaged with new technologies, they have better links to industry. And I'm not saying that tourism is not going to be a good, you know, an industry that will survive in Greece, or that, you know, you'll stop getting your Greek yogurt or olive oil in the store. But I think there should be more than that. And I think it's going to be a hard, you know, the next generation, the current generation, the young people right now are going to have a hard time. But the question is, how do you get out of it, and what kind of a country do you get out of this? Mm-hmm. And if they decide to stick to the traditional industries, I think it's not going to look very good. But it's definitely going to be tough, very tough.
In this hour focus, we're talking about Greece and about recent economic problems there and also in Europe. And we'll talk some more with our guest, Kostas Kotikakis, after a short break. This is Focus.
I'm David Thiel from WILL-TV. Join me this October for a Friends of WILL tour of London, Yorkshire, and Wales. We'll see stately homes and splendid scenery with connections to some of our most popular TV programs. Three-night stays in each of our locales offer us plenty of free time. Call us at 217-333-7300 or visit will.illinois.edu for more information.
Programs on WILL are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, inviting audiences to enjoy Krannert Uncorked, a weekly free wine tasting almost every Thursday at 5 p.m. in the lobby. More information is available at krannertcenter.com.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here weekday mornings with 10 different topics. In the second hour today, we're going to the archives. We had to make a small change because the guest we had scheduled was not able to be with us. So on another day, we'll talk with Pamela Constable about her book, Playing with Fire. It's about Pakistan. Instead, you'll hear an interview going back a little further than we usually do. This was from 2009. Carol Yoon talking about her book, Naming Nature. Then tomorrow morning at 10, we will look at the role that Britain played in America's Civil War. Amanda Foreman will be the guest. She's written a book on this. The title is A World on Fire, in which she makes the argument that perhaps the most crucial thing that Britain did in the Civil War was not to get involved. That is, it did not take sides. That's tomorrow. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. You can look at the schedule by going to our website, will.illinois.edu. In this hour, our guest is Kostas Kotikakis. He's a research assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at University of Illinois here in Urbana-Champaign. He's interested in politics and the European Union, and we're talking about the economic crisis that's now going on, has been going on for some time now in Europe, and questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, I want to come back to what... we've talked a little bit about this, I think, but some more about the political issues here. And maybe there was one real big political issue that you have to consider, and that is at the very beginning, and the whole project of unification took some very big, very powerful countries with very big economies. Mm-hmm. And put them together with some rather small ones, or certainly smaller ones. Okay. I guess that the question is, can that really work? Given that there is such a spread in the power of all of the various players.
First of all, in European Union studies, we don't use the word unification. Or the word federation. They're both no-nos. They raise a lot of eyebrows and they cause a lot of anger in some quarters. We like to use the term European integration, that countries integrate. It's semantics, but it matters. Okay, so we're not going to, the predominant discourse right now is that this whole project of European integration that started in the 1950s is not necessarily going to lead to a federation, to a new federal United States of Europe or something like that. But it's bringing them closer and closer together. There are sovereign nations. They maintain control over their territories and a lot of their own policies. They delegate, they pool sovereignty. That's the term that's used. So they're not really giving it up. They're just putting it in a common pot, this sovereignty, which means in practice they delegate certain policies to common institutions, the institutions of the European Union. Now, about the question of big and small countries, this strikes a lot of people like a puzzle, but you need to understand that the EU is a lot more than just the euro. It's a larger project, as I mentioned. Mm-hmm. It started in the 1950s with, in fact, a lot of small countries in it. So the first name of the European Union was the European Coal and Steel Community, which was established in 1950. And the members of that organization were France, Germany, and Italy, big countries, and three little, real small countries, Belgium, the Netherlands, and Luxembourg. And the idea behind that was, how do you prevent a new war, a new world war, from breaking out in Europe? Of course, small countries, when they heard that, they said, well, sign me up for that. I mean, Belgium was right in the middle of Germany and France during World War I, and a lot of the major battles of World War I took place there. And, you know, they've been subject to a lot of brutality as part of those world wars. And so small countries wanted to join because they thought it was a very good, a very, you know, interesting and sort of peace project. And this has created a momentum. And the rationale has always been that economic integration is not an end in itself. It has a political purpose. It's not unification necessarily, but it's preventing war, preventing conflict between the countries of Europe, which, you know, anybody who knows anything about European history, they know that, you know, peace is not usually the word that's used to describe European history. And so that's the rationale. So and a lot of countries, so they joined because of that. Then after a certain point, especially in the most recent additions of countries, it became sort of it's I don't know how to describe, but it's sort of like this became this big. Again, I'm going to use the club analogy. It became this democratic, prestigious club. And countries want to join because they feel in Europe, because they feel like if they join the EU, they made it somehow. Now they're important, they're great. And so a lot of times those considerations override the hard economic facts, which is that these economies are not very compatible with each other. And so what happens very often is that countries join and then they say, well, we'll just make it work somehow economically. And this is, for example, what happened with the in 2004 when 10 countries from Central and Eastern Europe, that's former communist countries, joined the EU. A lot of people say, you know, what were they doing in the EU? But the idea was there, and I'm not saying that that's right, but a lot of people wondered about that. And what they were doing is that they wanted to be part of this club, be able to influence developments. They wanted to sort of participate in big decisions that are made in Europe. Their economies were not as robust. They were not as developed, perhaps, as those of Germany or the Netherlands. But they said, we'll just join and we'll make it work. And some of them have actually made it work, but some others haven't. Hmm.
Well, I just I promise I have a couple of callers I get read to, but I think that I ask the question because it seems that this the economic pressures that these countries are facing now have really brought to the surface some latent tensions between the bigger members of the club and the smaller members of the club. And you can certainly, it seems to me, you can see that just, for example, looking at the things in Germany and in Greece, mm-hmm. they're saying about the other countries.
Okay. Well, I don't think it's a division between big countries and small countries. Mm-hmm. It's between different economic philosophies. Mm-hmm. Because the Netherlands, for example, and Finland, which are small countries, are in the same camp as Germany as far as this debate, this conflict is concerned. While, you know, Italy, for example, and Greece are pretty much on the same side. Portugal is small. So I think it's, there is a lot of tension that is hiding there. There is a lot of misperception and misconceptions about countries. And that's why I think, in fact, that the solution to this problem, the long-term solution, is not economic. It's more cultural and political. So there has to be, if the European Union is to survive and is to continue successfully, they have to find a way, these politicians, these great minds in Europe, to bring people together so that Greeks feel more responsible and, the Greek government is more responsible and, you know, does, you know, perform its responsibilities. And then Germany feels that if it's necessary, they can transfer funds to weaker economies. But you can't do that if the Greek citizens do not communicate, really. I mean, there is different media markets, for example. So there are Greeks read different magazines and newspapers than the Germans do. So there's not really connection when it comes to the information that they get. So I think it's time for the EU to sort of start looking at that. It's not going to eliminate the divisions. I mean, think about the U.S., for example, which has been a country for a long time. And you can still see people from the South and people from the North, you know, not really seeing eye to eye on a lot of things, or people on the East side of the United States and the West side of the United States. And you see there is always going to be divisions in Europe. But the question is, how do you try to sort of create some common ground for everybody so they can communicate and see eye to eye on, you know, a number of issues?
All right. Well, let's talk with some of the callers here. We have a couple of them in Urbana. We'll start with line one. Hello.
Hello. The professor is a political scientist, and he once used the word democracy in this discussion, but I think that that's a very serious concern about how well the European Union and the monetary system fits with a conception of democracy. And it's very interesting, we're talking about Greece, where Western democracy was born, because I think there are, in some fundamental ways, an undermining of democracy in the individual country. They can say they're sovereign, but they are so constrained that, in fact, they have lost control over their economic policy, significant control over their monetary and their fiscal policy. And I think economics has completely overwhelmed the political here. There are two, I think, elements of this. One is that there is a very powerful bureaucracy, both a political and a financial bureaucracy in the European Union, the European Central Bank, which is making decisions which none of the countries can control, and the citizens of the countries can't control those decisions. Secondly, there's the question of the lack of transparency. You said yourself that you didn't know the role of the investment houses. I'm sure there's a lot of banking and financial interests that are involved in this. And we don't know the answer. We can't see the answers because they're hidden. And that's a disaster for democracy in any one of these countries. So I think the problems are, what do we mean when we say these countries remain sovereign? What does that mean to the citizens of those countries? And are these small countries really just at the mercy of larger, primarily economic policy? I think it's somewhat similar to what's happening in the United States, in fact, that our democracy is being subsumed by economic power. For example, if the Greeks really want to have free public education, why can't they do that? Wouldn't that be something that citizens, if citizens want it in a country, that a country would say it's the best investment we can make is in our youth. Let's educate them. Let's regard that as a primary need and a primary concern. We could say the same thing about health care, about any number of things, decent pensions for people to live. But increasingly, I think, the issue is one of democracy, and I'd like to hear the professor address that.
Yeah, well, you have laid a lot out there. Let's say we only have about 5 minutes left. So,
About the issue of democracy, that's a very interesting point, by the way, that the listener is raising. If you look at I study institutions in the European Union, and if you look at the institutions, how they're laid out, how they're structured, it looks very democratic. You know, there is accountability mechanisms, delegation and accountability mechanisms. It all looks very legit and very democratic. The problem is that nobody, or at least the citizens, are not willing to use those mechanisms. And the main example I like to use is that they can elect the members of the European Parliament. Turnout in European Parliament elections tends to be very low, about 20-30%, which is extremely low for European standards, where in national elections you have a turnout of 70-80%. So 30% is really, really bad. But I think, so it's democratic as far as the design of the whole European Union is concerned, and how state and government interests are represented and citizens' interests are represented. Now, the issue of sovereignty, There are also safeguards in the European Union and the way it's structured to make sure that countries have their sovereignty respected and they have their voice heard. I think that's, but I will agree with the listener, though, that the economy is brutal sometimes. And world economy, these countries are part of this international economic system. And now this system happens to be in a crisis and they need to adjust to that. So I don't think that, so that compromises their sovereignty. There's no question about this. That's the case for Greece. But it's hopefully, that's the one thing I hope, is that it's a sacrifice that can be done and it's going to be for the short term, for a long-term benefit, so that later on, after they exit the crisis, you know, they may have to cut down on healthcare and spending now so that the country can get out of the crisis and perhaps invest again in those very important services to the people later. It's definitely a very tough time, and countries, because of the crisis, and because small countries or even big countries like Germany, because Germans are not very happy about this either. I mean, they have to transfer funds to Europe, so their sovereignty is also compromised in a way because they can't spend their money any way they want. So hopefully that's only a temporary situation, and it will correct itself later.
Make sure we get one more caller here. This is line number two. This is also someone in Urbana. Hello.
Hello. Yes, my question is very similar to the last caller's question. It seems to me that the real problem in Greece, Italy, and perhaps Spain and Portugal is a taxation system which is not working. Everyone is avoiding paying taxes, but it is really the upper income group which is profiting most by this. And that really isn't a matter of not being able to finance education for the masses and pensions and medical care, but that the very affluent are unwilling to assume their share of the burden. The correction that has been imposed upon Greece, it seems to me, falls entirely upon the lower class and the middle class, and that the very wealthy, the ship owners and the others, are not paying any cost. And it seems to me that is what is coming in this country as well. Would you care to comment on this?
Well, I'm not sure, I know enough about Portugal and Spain, but what you're describing is definitely true in the case of Greece. I would like to give sort of an example of how that works in real life. Say you go to a doctor and you receive a service, and the doctor says to you, do you want a receipt or not? If you want a receipt, then, you'll pay, say, 100 euros for the visit. But if you don't want a receipt, you'll pay 60 euros for the visit. What would you choose? If you were the patient in this case, you would probably go for 60 euros, and then which is cheaper to you. But that means that the doctor will not issue a receipt. So when the IRS of Greece goes out and asks them to pay taxes, they can't find that income. There are similar sort of techniques, so to speak. And it's usually people who make a lot of money that can evade taxes. That's a huge, huge problem. And that's a problem that at least the Greek government will need to address sooner rather than later. Unfortunately, to deal with the current crisis, this doesn't seem to be possible. This is a long-term project because it requires a major reform of a major government agency, and I don't think it can happen in the course of a year or two. There are ways that have been suggested for Greece to deal with this problem in the short term. They're asking about, independent external agencies to do that, but it's very controversial. But it's definitely a huge problem. It needs to be addressed. And it's a fundamental question of social justice, in fact, And one of the reasons why people are demonstrating, or they demonstrated in the streets, is that because they feel they have to pay the price while some other people do not.
Hmm. Well, I appreciate the comments of the caller. We just have about a minute or so left. Not unfair for me to ask the question, but I think that there, in spite of what particularly one caller back said, I think that there are a lot of people who make the argument that the issue here is it's not lack of sovereignty for individual countries, it's too much. And that for the Union and the Eurozone to be successful, in fact, there's got to be more central control than there is now.
Well, that's very controversial. This goes back to the issue of federation. But that's one of the ways out of this, is make the EU more powerful, delegate more sovereignty to the European Union. Mm-hmm. But if that were to happen, that would create major, major problems in Germany and in other countries in the European Union, where they don't really want more powers to be given to the EU. They're saying we've given the EU enough powers already. It seems to be misusing them, or the EU is not using them appropriately. So even if should we give them even more? It's politically very, very difficult to sell to a lot of electorates in Europe right now, but it would definitely be a solution, perhaps a better solution than just taking everything apart.
Yeah. And is that likely, that things might fall apart?
I don't think so. It's definitely theoretically a possibility. But look, this is not the first crisis the EU has been through. It's been through other crises, not as big as this one, of course. This is the most important crisis in the history of the EU. But in the 60s, for example, there were major battles about different issues, and everybody thought that the EU would fall apart. But there's just too much at stake. These economies in Europe are so closely intertwined that it's very difficult to take them apart. So I think it's going to be a very difficult and bumpy road, but I think they're in a way stuck together for quite a while.
And there, for the moment, we'll have to leave it. Our guest, Kostas Kotikakis, is Research Assistant Professor in the Department of Political Science here at U of I Urbana-Champaign. Thanks very much.
Thank you. It was my pleasure. Yeah.